Hey, listeners, welcome to Music in Time on WGXC. I'm your host, Evan McCormick. I'm a historian by day and a music lover by spooky, spooky night. Here's the brief on my show. Every episode, I pick an album and I use it to explore the history surrounding that album's release. Now, this episode, we're going to be looking at an album called Juju by Susie and the Banshees, released on June 19th, 1981. Now, this is one of the all-time hauntingest albums. It's a record imbued with the supernatural, dark forces, and evil that stands the test of time. It's still audible all these years later. And as Halloween approaches, I wanted to ask, what is it about this album that makes us hear it like that? Is it all in the music itself? Or was there something happening when this record came out that might have helped filter that creepy sound of the record to a listener, even all these years later? Arabian Nights, a killer single off of Juju by Susie and the Banshees, the album we're looking at on Music in Time today on WGXC. Susie and the Banshees had been formed in 1976 by Susan Janet Ballion, alias Susie Sue, and bassist Stephen Severin, both out of Southeast London. They had been fixtures in the punk scene with ties to the Sex Pistols, for example. But Susie and the Banshees were always just a little bit different, more conceptual, driven to create really out there artistic sounds on each of their first three albums, The Scream in 1978, Join Hands in 1979, and Kaleidoscope in 1980. With Susie's elaborate face makeup, the band's relentless rhythm and almost draping guitars, the sound is something more like the precursor to goth than punk. Vivian Goldman once wrote, quote, "They sound like a 21st century industrial plant." That's a compliment. But even amongst the other albums in their catalog, there's just something about the way this album Juju sounds. The otherworldliness of Susie Sue's voice, the violent, almost slashing sounds of John McGeoch's guitar. It's why it's considered one of their classics. It's been nodded to as a reference point by bands from U2 to the Smashing Pumpkins. And it's why I wanted to explore it today. Not because it's a classic, but to understand that haunting power that persists down through the years. To understand what circumstances birthed this album. And to answer that question, you have to go back to the time and place. Great Britain's long summer of 1981. In 1981, Britain, like much of the world, was facing serious economic troubles. A recession brought on by the energy crisis of the previous several years. High gas prices had roiled the international economy, driving up inflation into the double digits. Sound familiar? Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher had responded in 1981 by imposing taxes, unlike some more contemporary Tory prime ministers, but a wave of shutdowns had struck factories and shipyards. If you read the headlines around Juju's release in June of 1981, you can see Britain's unemployment rate creeping up to its highest level since the Depression of the 1930s. But there was something else in those headlines linked to the economic malaise. It was racial tensions and violence. In 1981, a series of riots swept the country of Great Britain. They started in April in Brixton in London, when systematic police brutality against minority communities led to 3 days of intense rioting involving as many as 5,000 people. Several dozen buildings burned out and hundreds of injuries sustained. That summer, the Thatcher government ordered an inquiry into the causes of the Brixton riots, led by Leslie George Scarman, a barrister and judge. The Scarman report, released in November, would place much of the blame for the riots on the minority communities themselves. The idea that what had caused the riots was the inability to foster a relationship between those communities and the British state, and virtually none of the blame on the police. That report, and the lack of law enforcement reform that accompanied it, has been rightly pilloried in the years since. But it points to just how tumultuous this period was. That summer, in July, clashes between law enforcement and minority communities occurred in Birmingham, in Leeds, and in Liverpool, to name only a few of the dozen or so riots that erupted in the summer of 1981. Reading British newspapers in the weeks around Juju's release, one really gets the sense of a society on the knife's edge.
From the cradle bars comes a beckoning voice that sings spinning. You have no choice.
You hear life.
Welcome back to Music in Time on WGXC. I'm your host, Evan McCormick. This is the show that puts music in its historical context. And on this Halloween episode, we're listening to Susie and the Banshees' Juju, which was released in the middle of June 1981, a tumultuous time in Great Britain as the country was riven by racial tensions and rioting, while also being in the midst of a crushing economic recession. But what does all this have to do with Susie and the Banshees? It's a great question, since the band never argued that their music had a political tint. In fact, they were even reluctant to suggest that the dark themes of the album had been intentional. Stephen Severin, the founding bassist of the band, said that the album was a concept album, but in one interview he said, quote, "It wasn't pre-planned, but as we were writing, we saw a definite thread running through the songs, almost a narrative to the album as a whole." But here's one of the conceits of my show. It's not actually so important what the musicians say or intend, but more so what the listeners hear and experience. And that's something that happens between the album and the world around the listener. From the minute one picks up this album, the supernatural themes are heavy. The name of the album is a reference to West African religious practices. The record sleeve features a picture of an African mask that the Banshees apparently came across at the Horniman Museum in Forest Hill in London. And then there's the dark sound, which requires no explanation. You'll hear it throughout the show. On the record itself, so much of that dark energy comes from Susie Sue herself and her lyrics. But what's interesting to me is that while it's dark, it never invites the listener to engage in anything campy. There's no mention of vampires or werewolves. Quite to the contrary, there's a lot of imagery of children on the album experiencing a world that's strange and disorienting. Like in the lyrics to Spellbound, which I played earlier, which portrays a child or perhaps someone through flashback having visions of toys, taking on a life of their own in ritualistic dance, calling on someone to commit evil deeds. And Susie had a notoriously rough childhood, as anyone who followed the band or Susie Sue in particular might have known at the time. Later in life, she gave an interview in which she talked about the influence this had on her songwriting. She said, quote, "I grew up having no faith in adults as responsible people, and being the youngest in the family, I was isolated. I had no one to confide in. So I invented my own world, my own reality. It was my own way of defending myself, protecting myself from the outside world. The only way I could deal with how to survive was to get some strong armor." And that, to me, is where so much of what makes this album haunting comes from that childlike, almost nostalgic view of making sense of the strange, dark things afoot. Here's an example from the album of that darkly tinged nostalgia. It's the song Halloween, followed by an artist who took the horror music genre in a slightly more campy direction, Roki Erickson's Night of the Vampire from 1981's cult favorite, The Evil One.
The night is still and the
You know, it's worth saying at this point that something that made Susie Sue's persona so powerful was the fact that she was a woman in a punk and post-punk music scene and a music industry that was dominated by men. It had been Susie Sue, after all, who faced the creepy comments of TV host Bill Grundy during the infamous interview with the Sex Pistols that featured, you know, rude words. There's this great article in the Punk Girl Diaries, an awesome zine, shout out, you can go find it online, that details some of the awful questions that Susie used to get from journalists that ranged from openly sexist to just unbelievably banal, and how deft she had become at frustrating reporters with this kind of mystic persona. But you know, there was a darker side to this gendered aspect of music at the time. In January of 1981, just 6 months before Juju came out, British police apprehended Peter Sutcliffe, a gravedigger and serial killer known as the Yorkshire Ripper, who had killed women, many of them sex workers, between 1975 and 1980, while the British police failed to apprehend him in a long, flawed investigation. This sense of terror in Northern England around this time was particularly acute for women. Well, Susie and the Banshees channeled that terror into song, perhaps better than anyone. She said in an interview, it was after a journalist had told her about the case. And for my money, this song I'm about to play is the most haunting one on the album, given just how real and how raw that terror was in 1981, with Sutcliffe having been found guilty in May, just before Juju was released. Here is Night Shift by Susie and the Banshees off of Juju, followed up by another serial killer tale and song. It's The Nymph's 1991 The Highway, about women obsessed with LA's infamous night stalker, Richard Ramirez.
Out of my mind with you. Yeah.
Welcome back to Music in Time on WGXC. I'm your host, Evan McCormick, and today we're talking about Juju by Susie and the Banshees, which was released in June 1981, a time of racial tension and economic malaise in the UK. I suggested before I played those last songs that there's something more than just plain spookiness about the tracks on this record, that there are certain moments when the themes of the supernatural, of haunting, can be particularly effective in conjuring for listeners a belief in dark forces being at work, and that might affect how we remember these songs as well. So in that vein, I'd like to do what I do on this show, which is to think about echoes in time and other moments where listeners might have heard something like that or songs that might embody that same kind of connection between listener and moment. And the first is Screamin' Jay Hawkins' I Put a Spell on You, an absolute classic that was conceived of originally as a ballad before a riotous recording session turned it into an out-of-control rock song released in 1956. The song's nod to the supernatural was hugely popular with listeners and live audiences, and I don't think I'm going out on a limb here when I say that the supernatural appeal here is the affront to the conservative sexual mores of the 1950s. And although Screamin' Jay Hawkins would embrace the spookiness in his stage show involving coffins and other forms of camp, he would also bemoan the way that the song turned him into something of a spooky icon, at one point saying, quote, "Why can't people take me as a regular singer without making a boogeyman out of me?" The second song I want to play is Nick Cave's Red Right Hand, now a classic thanks to it being featured in probably some TV show you're streaming at the moment, but it's this imagination of an evil devil-like character at work. And it was released in 1994 on Cave's album, Let Love In. And if you think about the timing for that song, the dawn of the 1990s, capitalism, there are shades of urban growth in this song, of hero worship, of money. He's a god, Cave sings. He's a man. He's a ghost. He's a guru. He's got stacks of green paper in his red right hand. Now, some of these timeless elements are in a lot of Nick Cave's songs. I mean, not for nothing is he the Prince of Darkness. But Red Right Hand, above all, seems to capture in the imagination of listeners that intersection of greed and evil in the modern age.
I put a spell on you. Because you're mine. Stop the things you do. What's up?
Oh, you're mine. the viaduct looms like a bird of doom as it shifts and cracks. Where secrets lie in the border fires and the humming wires. Yeah, man, you know you're never coming back. Across the square, across the bridge, past the mills, past the stacks. On a gathering storm comes a tall, handsome man in a dusty black coat with a red right hand. We'll wrap you in his arms, tell you that you've been a good boy. He'll rekindle all the dreams that took you in. Lifetime to destroy. He'll reach deep into the hole, heal your shrinking soul, but there won't be a single thing that you can do. He's a god, he's a man, he's a ghost, he's a guru. They're whispering his name through this disappearing land, but hidden in his coat is a red right hand. Respect, you feel like an insect. Well, don't you worry, buddy, 'cause here he comes through the ghettos and the barrio and the barry and the slum. His shadow is cast wherever he stands. Stacks of green paper in his red right hand.
You know, haunting isn't always about the fear factor. There's something about ghosts, about the spectral, that has to do with time, about things from the past that linger, that can't be laid to rest. And if you think about it, so much haunting is about nostalgia, particularly in the British case, right? Castles, mansions, manor houses. What's lost from a bygone era? And that's not so different from what's happening on this album, Juju, by Susie and the Banshees. Only the basis for that nostalgia, childhood, we find on the album is a much darker, uncertain place. And if you think about the context in which listeners would have been hearing this and reckoning with those themes in 1981, with the country on the knife's edge of social conflict and economic malaise, it's almost like a different kind of specter is haunting the listener. I would argue it's a different way to think about haunting. There's something going on here in which form is mirroring function. In the Banshees record, you can hear a music that's growing out of the punk milieu that was all about railing against authority and growing into something more mature, more adult, a form of music that was capable of reckoning with much deeper harms that were buried in the artists and in society itself. And that, listener, is what we call post-punk, the thing that came after anarchy in the UK, but that was tapping into a much deeper and foreboding sense about the forces at work in politics, in society, the dark forces lurking in everyday life. And that, for me, is what this album captures. When you think about it in the context of the summer of 1981, it's even spookier, and it's why it's a perfect Halloween album, despite being released in June. And on that note, to end, here's one more off of Juju. Here's Susie and the Banshees, Sin in My Heart. Thank you. Well, that's all for today's special Halloween episode of Music in Time on WGXC. I'm your host, Evan McCormick. I've had a blast talking about Susie and the Banshees' Juju from June of 1981. Over the last few episodes, I've tried out a few different formats: the deep dive on a particular album, the interview format, mixtape style show. And I'd love to get some feedback from the listeners out there to know if there's any format that you think is particularly good or any format that maybe doesn't work so well. So find me on social media, on Instagram, on Twitter, or on Facebook, and let me know what you think. Otherwise, we'll be back on the fourth Wednesday of November for another Sonic Time Travel Trip. See you then.